Session number 27077.
John Ross, Reel 2.
I was interviewed there. I can't remember anything about that, although I remember I had to see a psychiatrist for some reason. I don't know if everybody did. And all I can remember, I was asked, "Are you afraid of death?" So the answer was yes. I can't remember anything else about the interview whatsoever. But they apparently accepted me. And I hadn't told the anti-aircraft people I was working with I was doing this. And a day or two later, I was summoned to the brigadier or the general or someone there, and he said, "You're wanted in the MO4 setup. I suppose it's because you speak an Eastern European language." So I said, "Yes, sir," which was an absolute lie, but I felt I had to do my best to get out, and so I was released. Perhaps I ought to mention there were various other reasons why I wanted to get out of the unit. It's a silly story, but I'd made a bit of a fool of myself there. The general in charge of the AC-ACC setup had an ADC, his nephew. It was all rather nepotism, I think, around those parts, and a dreadful job being an ADC to a general. But the ADC went on leave, and I was asked to do the job, which was very boring. But eventually, the general was being posted back to England, and it was arranged that I'd see him off at the airfield, which was about 50 miles outside Cairo. And so I arranged with his chauffeur to come and fetch me at 11 o'clock in the evening or something like that. We'd pick up the general and take him out there. And according to the chauffeur, he did knock on my door and didn't get any response. So he went off with the general, and I'd fallen asleep in my room and woke up after a while and realized, oh my God, I've missed the general. And so I went out into Cairo and found a taxi and went out to the airfield, and the plane was delayed going back to England. And for about the next 3 or 4 hours, the general gave me absolute hell for not coming out. I mean, what use I was, I don't know, but I saw him off and thought it was time I left general headquarters after that. So I joined MO4. And it was a strange business because I had no idea what was going to happen. But I found myself sent out to a house on the outskirts of Cairo, and there were about 20 people there. They were all young officers who'd fairly recently come out from England and had been training specially for Special Forces activities, and it involved things like going on intelligence courses, mule handling courses, going up to the Cedars of Lebanon to do skiing and mountaineering training, and so on and so forth. And they'd also done all their parachute training in England. And there were one or two older people who'd been around the Middle East doing some sort of subversive activities there, but it was a very interesting time with these. And we hung around though on the edge of Cairo doing absolutely nothing until we were all sent up after a week or two to an establishment called ME-102 on Mount Carmel in above Haifa. And that was a wonderful course. There was an enormous amount of instruction about the German army. It was mainly instruction about the German army and instruction in sabotage methods. And I mean, we used to go and blow things up in a local quarry, or go down and drive steam engines to know how what part to blow up, or lay dummy mines on railway lines around Haifa. It was very good training.
How would you blow up an engine locomotive?
heaven knows, I can't remember now. It was a question of just putting your charge in the right place, perhaps, or the easy place where the outside of the pistons were, something like that. And I think we were going to do it on submarines, but something stopped us visiting the submarines. And we did, all kinds of fascinating things, like learn how to carry limpets, which you swam across and plastered them on the outside of ships. And so it was very good training there, and very good instructors. Now, I can't remember whether it was there or in the intelligence course earlier. There was a famous conjurer called Jasper Maskelyne, and he gave talks on how to conceal things on in your body in various ways, maps or odds and ends. And so that was the best part of a month there.
Had you heard of Maskelyne before?
Oh, yes, I'd seen him in London as a conjurer, yes, with a family. But we were then went back to Cairo, and we didn't really know what was going to happen.
Can you remember some of the other officers on the course?
Oh, yes.
Who were you with?
Well, I think some of the ones I've mentioned. There was this chap became a very good friend, Jim Beat, who he'd been with an Essex regiment, I think, but he was a sort of heavyweight boxing champion of the army, and he was with us. I think Richard Tolson, I've told you about, who was a regular officer from a Sussex regiment, the chap Taylor, who I can't remember how he'd come. I can remember about half a dozen. And one got quite friendly with quite a lot of them. But then we all went back to Cairo, and we didn't know what we were going to do. And I think several of us were interviewed because they wanted someone to go to Crete to join Moss and Lee Fermor. And I don't know who was selected. I certainly wasn't. And perhaps no one was, but I can't remember that. And then suddenly we were told that we were to go, they were opening up Italy for what they call British liaison officers, and we were to go over to Italy. And so we were shipped over there in a transport together with the 53rd, I think it was, division, who were going into to Anzio, I suppose, or Salerno. Anzio, yes. Sorry, is that of interest,
yes,
to go
yes.
on there? And so we went over and landed at Taranto, I suppose it was, and went by train over to Monopoli, which was the headquarters there of Number 1 Special Force. And we were attached to them, living in little villas under very pleasant conditions. And not even then knowing what we were doing, some people were going. Did also go into Greece eventually, and there were people living there who were coming back from Albania, coming back from Yugoslavia.
Is this a place called Castellana? I don't know if that
that's right.
That.
I think it was called Castellana, yeah. Just outside.
Yeah.
That's clever of you. Just outside Monopoli. The headquarters was actually in Monopoli, but our villas were at Castellana. Yeah. I think that's right. I think so. At any rate, I can't remember the names.
How much contact did you have with the at this stage with the staff of Number 1?
Negligible. In fact, I mean, we did incredibly little. There was a sort of course, and things like you sort of crept around through jungle-like conditions, with targets popping up at you, which you shot at, and there was practice with mortars and things, but incredibly little training. But the others, all those who come out from England, had done their parachute work, and I hadn't. And I went down and did a 4-day course at Brindisi and got passed out as a parachutist after 4 days, which was rather extraordinary.
How did you find that course?
It was delightful. It was a Polish officer looking after us who started off his talk by saying there are two big thrills in life, and one of them is parachuting, which are quite good. And we did, I think it was incredibly simple. We did 2 days, sort of really physical exercise and sliding down ropes and learning about parachutes. 2 days, but most of it was sitting by the sea there and swimming and doing very little. And then we did 2 days of drops, and then you were passed out. And I mean, the drops are ideal conditions, lovely calm weather and beautiful flat pleasant grass to drop onto.
How disturbing an experience did you find that?
But it was always a bit alarming getting out of the plane, and I think the first time I went out, I went out rather upside down because the chap in front of me decided he didn't like it, and he stopped just as we were jumping out. So I went, tripped over him and fell out very much the wrong way, but so I was a bit worried. But actually floating down, and it was a rather lovely experience. And then we were sent back to our units. And then, as far as I remember, that was when I met Bill Tillman. When I got back, instead of going to the, back to the villas where we'd been, I can't remember why, I was sent by myself to help, if possible. That there was a lovely old castle there where there were two or three sergeants or sergeant majors who were training Italian agents in unarmed combat and things like that, which I was supposed to help with. Not that I knew much about unarmed combat, and sort of climbing on ropes and things, which was interesting but fairly unpleasant, but it was a lovely place. And then Tillman came there as well, I don't know why, and we spent quite a lot of time together and swimming. And I think that's why we got and we also trained doing long marches or walks carrying heavy weights, which is quite good. And that's why I suppose he got to know me and asked me to join him when he was to go into Northern Italy.
How much notice did you get before you went?
I suppose not more than a week or two. I think suddenly they'd opened up Northern Italy. I mean, a lot of number one special forces activities were people are going across the lines, I think, and but dropping people in the distance hadn't taken place much. And I think John Wilkinson and Chris Woods were about the sort of one of the first to sort of go in right up north there, and they'd only been in several weeks when we went to go in and join them, and then move to our own area.
And how did your mission come together? The various members of there were four of you, I think, weren't there?
Yes, we were joined only a short while before we were due to go off by Vittorio Gozza, who was to be our interpreter. And as I told you, he'd escaped from the Germans and got onto Anzio beachhead and then entered Rome, and then afterwards joined the number one special force. And we were allocated a radio operator who was supposed to be good. We hadn't much faith in him. He was a rather fat chap who'd worked in submarines before, so we had no idea how good he would be. In fact, he was, I think, would have been hopeless. And I think we had very little notice before we were going to be sent off, and went down, I think, as I mentioned to you, to the headquarters in Monopoly to be briefed, which was really pathetic, because the staff there knew virtually nothing about the area we were to go and work in, which was round Belluno in the sort of beginning of the Dolomites there, and take in all that area. And they had very little idea of what the resistance movement was doing there, although there must have been a lot of Italian agents around who could have kept people informed. And they had very little idea of the geography. I mean, they had dreadful maps, which didn't, were not much good, and sort of pre-war picture postcards of the attractive areas, but nothing much else. And so, as a briefing, it was hopeless. And I mean, do you want to know about sort of being dropped in or not?
Yes, yes.
Well, yes, and then we were told that we were going to go off, and one was to go off from Brindisi Airport. So we were issued with our parachutes and things in Monopoly, and I think we were taken down by truck to, we were to go by night and taken down by truck to Brindisi, and given a wonderful meal in a flat there, which was once or Last Supper. It was very, very good. Then taken out to the airfield and into the DC-3s. And these were loaded with a lot of equipment which to be dropped to the resistance and us. We were loaded with us. And I think that first time, there was only our lot in it. That's right, Tillman, God's radio operator, and myself. And two Yugoslavs who really didn't speak English, who were meant to be the launchers pushing us out. And that first time, it was about 3 hours up to the north. And when they got there, there was no sign of the fires which should have been lit on the site. There must have been excellent navigation at night by the airmen, because I mean, one couldn't really see a thing, and I don't know how they knew where they were. There were no fires and no flashing lights, and it turned out later the Germans had been right by the dropping ground, so they didn't light anything up. And so we returned, and I think it was 2 days later, it was a second attempt, and again just our mission. And then when they got up north, we were told to stand by the door, to which we did, and so looking out, and we were just a little bit surprised to see an awful lot of lights down below, and then so orange things started coming up towards us, which we then realized anti-aircraft fire. And it turned out the plane was sort of was circling over Trieste for some reason. Heaven knows why. I mean, I've got no idea how it all happened. And I think I said, for heaven's sake, let's go. And Tillman wrote afterwards that he meant that I thought we ought to jump out, but I certainly didn't. I thought it was really quite bizarre that we were circling Trieste. And we then, so that we again returned down to Monopoly. I think I got rather alarmed, because I went forward to chat to the observer or whatever, the pilots, and my they gave us cups of tea. My parachute, I remember, caught on the tea urn tap, which emptied quite a lot of tea into my sort of parachute, and they didn't give me another one when I got back, and so I was always a bit worried that this wouldn't do it any good, but it was perfectly all right. And then the third time we went, and that was we were to put with another mission that time. That was Paul Breacher, John Orr Ewing, and their wireless operator, I think. Don't know if they had an interpreter. I can't remember it all. And certainly they were. They got exactly the right place. And they didn't drop out the equipment. Out went Paul Breacher and his mission, and they landed on the dropping ground fairly well. And then it began to get cloudy, and it became really rather difficult. And we were got out, and certainly it wasn't a cloud. And Tillman injured himself landing on rocks, but I mean there were rocks on the dropping ground anyhow. It was a pretty dreadful place. The submariner wireless operator panicked at the last moment, and we had to push him out, and he badly damaged the leg and retired, luckily. Victor landed perfectly well, the interpreter, and I landed in trees, which was rather a dreadful experience, because if you land on the top of trees, your parachute collapses and you can just fall the rest of the way to the ground. And so I thought that might be going to happen, but I was incredibly lucky. I went down slithering through the tree with all the ropes and things above me, and I ended up suspended upside down about 10 foot from the ground. But as a result, everything was tangled, and I sort of hit the release thing, and, you know, I couldn't release myself. So there I was suspended. Luckily, along came some people. I didn't know if it was going to be Germans or Italians or anyone else. And it was Italians who managed to sort of cut me down. So I was really very fortunate, because I wasn't injured at all.
And this was to John Wilkinson's?
That was into John Wilkinson's place, yes.
And you told me yesterday that about Wilkinson on... on COD, I think.
Oh, yes.
Could you perhaps repeat that?
Yes, he was a wonderful, tough, outgoing character, a huge blonde man, and this was probably his problem, because he used to, up in the north there, bicycle around, and was, I mean, very obviously not a local Italian, so I don't know why he did it. No, he'd been with the light anti-aircraft regiment, and on the Kos and Leros expedition, and when they had to pack up, because I mean the Germans were well informed about that invasion, he and a few other people whom he led swam apparently 11 miles to Turkey, where they were interned, and then returned to the Middle East, which must have been a pretty tough business. But he was a very active character. And so we then, after this landing, I think we walked quite a long way to where they were camping out somewhere in the woods. And I don't know if that was where Wilkinson and Chris Wood were normally working, or whether it was just while they were doing the dropping that they were camping there. I'm sorry, do you want to sort of go on at all?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. Well, if we perhaps talk about things that...
I'm sorry. No, it was an incredible experience and feeling to be like that sort of 500 miles from one's base and behind lines. And we were there, I think we were there only a sort of couple of nights, but during the day I walked to the sort of edge of the escarpment, overlooking the Po Valley and looking down on roads with German traffic on it, which was, having had so little to do with the Germans for 3 or 4 years of the war, to see it from that sort of angle was a remarkable experience. And it was obvious that Tilghman was not fit to move, because the plan had been that we'd walk to our, this was on the Alto Piano d'Asiago, we'd walk to our area, which is about 100 miles east, but he was obviously not up to it. So it was decided that Victor, the interpreter, and I would set off, and Tilghman would follow later with another radio operator, because, as I said, our submarino had been injured, and I think he was hidden away or may have been captured, but we never saw him again. And so Victor and I started off, and together with Breacher, and I don't know why, and Orr Ewing, who was to be attached to Breacher, didn't come. I can't remember. He possibly told you why he stayed behind with Wilkinson. And Breacher was to take charge or work with the partisan unit on Monte Grappa. And that was on our route to our area, and so off we went. And